Hello, 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 and welcome to the My Empty Hands podcast. I am Reggie Darden, and I have Joe Marilau with me, and we're going to talk some Kenpo and whatever else we happen to come across. I'm just really, really excited to have Joe on today because he is part of my first Kenpo lineage. And I feel like our side probably doesn't get as much mention as kind of some of the your usual Kenpo people. So I'm just really excited to kind of chat with Joe about my first instructor, Pete Salas. And just kind of the good old days of when he was coming up, and just real excited to have him on today. So to just kind of give a little bit of my background, I started in the mid 90s, and what was we called it Chinese Kenpo. The curriculum is basically the Tracy's version of Kenpo, and. So started there and worked my way about to about halfway to my third brown when I left for the Army. While I was in the Army, I got to do a little bit of Taekwondo, a little bit of Hapkido, a little bit of boxing. And once I got out of the military, I couldn't find a school that really fit my needs until I got involved in Capoeira. And so I've been doing Capoeira for coming up on 17 years now. But, I still always kept my love for Kenpo. And a few years ago, I sought out a school that would scratch the itch for me. And I found an American Kenpo school. And I've been training there for the last few years now. I guess it's been about coming up on a month now since I earned my green belt at the current school that I'm at, and just enjoying the journey and enjoying the training and excited for what's coming next. Also, eyeballing some other arts and things like that, but I like to say that I need 40 hours in the day because there's just not enough time to do all the training that I want to do. And, I'm having fun with it and we'll just, keep on rolling along. So now I'll, can turn it over to Joe, tell us, how Kenpo found you and, how it all started for you. And, we'll just kind of take it from there.
Okay, great. My journey into Kenpo started originally because of my youngest brother, Mill, who was taking karate lessons through the, Lerma brothers. Probably Pete would remember them through UKF over in National City. They bounced around, and then I eventually found a UKF studio that went to Imperial Beach, California. The instructor at the time there was a gentleman named Danny Valadez, who I went to high school with at Mar Vista. This is in the late 70s, it's 78. So I was halfway through graduating at San Diego State, and I decided, after college, I was committed to the Air Force. So I was going to the ROTC program there, Reggie, at San Diego State. And I decided to take Kenpo up just because my brother had been exposed to the UKF, and then they had a school there in IB down in Imperial Beach. So I went there for about 6-9 months, and I think they closed down. And then that's how I ended up finding Pete and Chicken and everybody else that was in probably the most famous UKF school for all those old school people that remember all the sides, pain in the side for Mr. Parker at Internationals back in the day, along with Nasty. So I ended up at that National City School. I know there, for a couple of years, it was really cool. I got to work with Pete, I obviously got to work with Chicken. I worked a few times with Nasty, you know, Steve Anderson, John Turnage. I'm sure Pete remembers John. He was in the Navy. I can't remember what his actual job was. And then also, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but Steve Anderson was in the Navy also, because I talked to him a little bit before I went into the service, and he was telling me he was in the Navy back in the 60s and 70s, probably right about the time that he got over to UKF. And then it was interesting working with Nasty. If you've ever had the chance to talk to Steve, as Pete describes him, he was larger than life.
I remember he came into the school, you know, while I was training. Actually, maybe it might have actually been before I started training. So I kind of left it out, but I was sort of stalking the school for probably about a year before I actually formally started training. So me and my best bud. We saw Jeff Speakman's The Perfect Weapon, and we're like we got to do that. And so, you know, when we found the school, I wasn't actually able to start, but my friend did. But I would just go, you know, as soon as the school opened, I was there, and I would sit there in the front and watch classes until we closed. And I did that just about every day
on Highland there, across from where there's a Walmart now in National City.
No, this is in the Chula Vista school.
Okay. If you've ever been to the martial arts supply store in National City, called Eagle Trading.
Yeah. Eagle Trading. I spent many a time there.
Base of UKF that I trained at with Chicken and Pete and Nasty and everybody else. So we're talking many moons ago, which no longer exists.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, you know, I would go and just hang out all the time. But yeah, I seem to remember a time or two when Nasty came by and it was like, ooh, like this is like a big deal to have a celebrity in here with us. So.
It must have been after his meteoric rise to fame, and then he eventually moved to Canada. I've worked in Canada for a couple of years up in Vancouver. So I found out that he was up there, but he was all the way over in Toronto while I was over in Vancouver on the opposite side of the country. So I didn't really touch bases with him, and I was surprised to see that he had passed years later when I was following up. We didn't have the internet back in the day, Reggie.
Yeah. Yeah. The internet is definitely changed things for the good and the worse, depending on how you want to look at it. But so let's go back to when you joined the military. So
so after graduation, I was in the U.S. Air Force for 4 years, from 80 to 84. I tried to find a place to train in Kempo. Now, oddly enough, if anybody's ever been up to Spokane, Washington, the Air Force base is located in the west side of the city. I ran across a gentleman that taught Kempo at the time, and this is the early 80s, by the name of Skip Hancock.
Yes.
Mr. Hancock is definitely, you know, one of the OGs with Mr. Parker. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Skip was his class was on the east side of Spokane, and I had to drive like well over 30 minutes to get out to his school. Now, if you've ever lived in eastern Washington, it's different than on the western side of the state. In the winter, gets cold and it gets nasty with the weather. So I actually, that's the one thing good about show and tell here, is that my certificate, I want to make sure here that I had gotten from Mr. Hancock here. I'll show you this here, Reg. So this is my blue belt certificate that I earned from Mr. Hancock. And this was given to me on the 7th day of March of 1982. And then I lasted only for a few months after that because I couldn't deal driving back and forth in the winter there and the horrible weather in Eastern Washington, of course, when I lived there. And so what happened was I was trying to find a place close to where I could train. I really hated leaving Skip, but it was just too much for me to deal with driving. So I ended up at, of all things, a taekwondo place that was down the street from where I lived. A gentleman by the name of John Buckman and his son, Dale Buckman. For anybody that's familiar, it was up near, it wasn't on Division, which is the main north-south route within Spokane, but it's a little bit northeast. And so I was there until I left the military in 1984. And I must have a certificate from the Buckmans. Let me see here. Oh, yes. I guess I had attained my blue belt certificate from the Buckmans there. And this is dated in Taekwondo, 1984, just before I separated from the Air Force and moved back to California. So at that point, 1984 rolls around. I was living in my ex-wife at the time was working in Pacific Bell for the phone company before they merged with AT&T. And we were living in the East Bay at the time. Well, we're in a place called San Ramon, California. So if you've ever been up to the Bay Area, it's huge. So I was thinking, well, how can I get back into Kempo? So I ran across a school in Santa Clara run by none other than Grandmaster John Sepulveda, who's also
an OG.
You know, and Mr. Sepulveda's school, I think, is still there out in Santa Clara Boulevard. I believe it was. And so I was there. What I would do was I would travel from San Ramon to Santa Clara, which is easily a 45-minute drive one way just in the traffic. If anybody's ever lived in the Bay Area, they understand my pain. You know,
I spent a lot of years living in Reno, and I would go to the Bay Area quite often. I know the trials and tribulations of that.
So, so you understand my pain. So I was there for a couple of years, living until my ex-wife got a transfer back to Southern California. I actually went back to San Diego. So this is like in 86s, 87, 88, somewhere in that time period. And I was still training. I would take an airplane up to the Bay Area. God, I know I couldn't get away with that with my ex-wife today, you know, flying back and forth between San Diego and Santa Clara just to go train with Mr. Sepulveda. If he didn't train, you know, at the time when I rolled into the class, into his school, I would train with one of his black belts a lot that I trained with as a gentleman named Howard Tapp. I don't know where Mr. Tabb is now. I know Mr. Sepulveda has taught a lot of students, so I know he's still very visible out there. But whenever John wasn't there, then I would train with Mr. Tabb. So Mr. Sepulveda was great. I remember one point in time he picked me up at the airport, I think at San Jose, in a Porsche that he had at the time. And I thought, you know, it was really cool to be picked up in a Porsche. And, you know, he had this 911 that was really cool. So, you know, I trained with Mr. Sepulveda, and I had obtained, this is my green belt from August of 1986 from Mr. Sepulveda. And then after that, I want to say, this is my second brown, but I'm trying to figure out here's my third brown. So this was awarded by Mr. Tested from Mr. Sepulveda in 1988. So as I continue the journey up there in the climb and probably making my ex-wife upset that I was flying back and forth to Santa Clara, and then that's when I decided, well, I got to go ahead and find another place to train. And I was currently in San Diego, you know, living and working. I ran across a gentleman who taught at Lemon Grove Kempo Karate, by the name of Darby Darrow. Darby now is training up. He has his own school up in Washington State, and he does mostly jiu-jitsu, but he still trains and he still teaches his Kenpo side. He awarded me my second brown belt. This was in, it looks like July of 91. Good. And then eventually I got my first degree brown in February of 1992. Now, this is interesting because the next part is that I would test for my first black. So I decided in August of 92 that, you know, I had gone to internationals, I think, the year before and competed as a brown belt. And if you've been to internationals, Reggie, back in the old school days, it was like a lot of people in every division. And you waited for hours, no matter what event you took on. So I decided that I wanted to find out if I could test for my first black. I had to ask Darby, and I think Darby was a little bit reluctant that I wouldn't do it there. But, you know, I was ready. Up here, I was ready. And so I tested for my first black. The head of the board was Senior Grandmaster Sepulveda. So, you know, it wasn't easy, but I got through the test. And hold on a second here. So this is the one that is most valuable to me in the Kenpo thing was in the Kenpo world. And the Ed Parker side was my first black.
Very nice. So
I tested in August, you know, at internationals, but Mr. Darrow got the certificate at his school in Lemon Grove on Broadway, if you're familiar with that area there. And he awarded that to me in December when the certificate came in. At that point, I was kind of like, well, what am I going to do? And this and that. And at that point, I had also gone into a different civilian job. I was, I'm actually retired law enforcement on the federal side, over 23 years working for Homeland Security. So that kind of like took me off in another direction while trying to train also at the same time. Also, I had a few, I was training with another guy because Mr. Darrow had closed his school down. And a guy by the name of Gary Wilson, who runs American Family Kenpo Karate out in Spring Valley, he's been there for years now. He's moved a couple locations. I was trying to find a place to train. I trained with him. His instructor was Willie Steele. So Mr. Steele also, I have a photo or two back in the day. He's one of the original founders or that peer group that trained under Mr. Parker, you know, and eventually I was with Gary in his school and they aligned with the original American Kenpo Karate Association. At that time, it was run by Mr. Hebler. So, you know, Mr. Hebler is doing well now. I see Mr. Hebler all the time on the internet. I follow him as he was one of Elvis's bodyguards. So I have a second and a third degree from OCA and American Family Kenpo, but I kind of was like, I kind of took the same approach that Pete did. Well, it was great to get the other degrees, but I was more interested in training. And for me, it was kind of the sparring thing that was really, you know, kind of got me to where I'm at right now in my combat arts journey. So an interesting side note, my ex-wife and me, we went over to some, I can't remember who actually ran this. There was a black belt banquet or a banquet for Kenpo artists somewhere in the LA area. And do you know who Mike Stone is?
Yes.
Okay. So Mr. Mike Stone was one of the speakers. Now this is well before the internet and there was all the, as I would find out years later, there was all this kind of like backdrop story that Miss Priscilla Presley and Mike Stone and all this other stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know any of that stuff. My ex-wife, who follows, you know, the gossip columns like, you know, like to this day, like paper, she was with me at this one banquet and Mike Stone happened to be a speaker there. And I can't remember if Chicken was there or Pete or anybody else. you know, or Mr. Parker's people, which I'm sure they were. Maybe Mr. Parker was even there, but all I remember was my ex-wife coming up to Mike Stone, and she said, and I just bugged her about this a few days ago. She goes, Mr. Stone, are you still dating Priscilla Presley? Now, you understand the ramification of that, Reggie, because of all the backstory on that. Mm-hmm. I had no clue, even for the first couple of months. And then as I started digging into it years later, I'm like, OMG, she really, really laid a landmine out there. Now, Mr. Stone was very cordial. He just said, I don't really have any comment on this.
It's the way to handle it.
Yeah, well, later on, years later, I just like taken aback by this. So fast forward, I was still training with Gary over at American Family Kempo out in Spring Valley. And Mr. Steele was actually technically my instructor, you know, when I would go, you know, talk to him about, you know, training. And, you know, Senior Grandmaster Wilson now, you know, was aligned with Mr. Hebler to go ahead and basically, you know, run that part of OCA. And I don't know if you, hold on, let me show you this other certificate here. This is one of the other OCA certificates that I got as a second degree. Mr. Hebler's signature is there, along with another person that I ran across that's very famous in the original circles of Kempo, is Mr. Richard Post. So Senior Grandmaster Post was very influential, you know, within OCA and Mr. Hebler. I don't know if you know anything about Mr. Post. He was actually a corrections officer for the state of California for many years. And he's done a podcast, which I've heard also. He's a huge man. He's about 6'3" or 6'4". And about 300 pounds. A big, big guy. And I remember he did a technique on me and I thought, I'm going to die. I was the dummy for him. So Mr. Post, I still follow him on Facebook. He's one of the funniest people that I know that sends out stuff. And so we're still continuing my Kempo journey, which is about to take an abrupt turn here. I was still training with Senior Grandmaster Wilson at his school and Mr. Steele when I got a chance to go work up in Vancouver, Canada. And so I jumped on it because I really wanted to go up there and see something different. And I was up there for a couple of years. There was no Kempo schools up there at the time. So I started training in Muay Thai. Now, that was a total divergence. And the only reason that I trained in Muay Thai was there was a gentleman who was training with Mr. Wilson at the time, way back in the day with us and Mr. Darrow by the name of Mike Asab, and he had taken a right turn and trained in Muay Thai and then came back into Kempo later on. I thought, you know what? Let me give it a shot. And it was like brutal because there was all these guys, you know, and Muay Thai is a totally different sparring type of environment than it is in Kempo and point fighting. We're talking, you know, actually rounds, you know, for 3 or 4 minutes and then maybe a break of about 30 seconds and you're, you know, fighting again. The worst part was all the preconditioning, which is all the, you know, skipping rope, a lot of footwork, a lot of just anything that was aerobic that you can think of running in place for like, you know, 30 or 40 minutes before, even if I got a chance to spar. But by then I was so exhausted. I'm like, God, am I going to live through this? And so I came back after 3 years of in Vancouver, Canada in 2013, and I ended up looking for a Muay Thai place to train at. Where I'm currently at is Arena MMA. And I've trained with a couple of guys that are teaching the class, where I'm very happy to go in there and try to survive my 1 hour of sparring class. And my body parts are just about not to fall apart anymore. But, you know, that's where I'm currently. And I currently train, you know, at least in the sparring class once a week. And I think I'm doing pretty good for a guy who's, you know, plus 55-ish. And I won't go anything over that.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I definitely know the feeling when I was boxing. You know, you walk in the door and you know, the minute the class starts, you're working until the minute the class ends. There's no breaks, no, you know, no, nothing like that. So yeah, I definitely, and that was just doing the training, not even, you know, doing the sparring part of it. Yeah, it's a heck of a workout. So I definitely know where you're coming from on that. Just to kind of jump back to the UKF days and
yes, sir,
being with Chicken and stuff. So, you know, those the, you know, students from that era, you know, a lot of great tournament fighters and stuff came out of there. So, you know, was that, I'm guessing that was also kind of a big part of your training then.
The sparring in the studio at the school was unbelievable because I'm a little bit shorter than Pete and all those gentlemen were much bigger. It was always a run and try not to get, you know, knocked out type of issue, you know. You know, the other person who wasn't tall, but he was very good at what he did, especially in the ring, was Chicken. And back in the day, if you saw Chicken back in the, you know, the early 80s, he was cut like glass and he was fast as lightning. It was unbelievable to see Chicken train, whether it'd been forms, fighting, you know, sparring in class. Chicken was just phenomenal. It was just unbelievable, you know. So to this day, I still try to emulate, you know, that I want to be there, even though I know my body's telling me other things, Reggie. And I think you get that. But
it
was just, you know, just within the school at UKF, you know, you had Pete, you had, you know, Chicken, you had Nasty, like I said, John Turnage. I think Pete mentioned on his podcast, Mike Ocasio, I believe. It was just an unbelievable array of fighters at that point that you just got exposed to, you know, just to see them, if you weren't getting beat up by them, just to see them fight amongst themselves, you know, preparing for a tournament was just unbelievable to this day that I've been, you know, and I always try to surround myself with fighters that are better than me because that's the only way I feel I got to push myself and learn. And, you know, I kind of get upset when I'm training with somebody that's lesser than me, which doesn't occur a lot, but, you know, you do run across it. But having to train with people that are much better than you, you want to aspire to be there. And that's why that dealing with that kind of environment was just an unbelievable sparring experience. And I couldn't find it ever again, except when I decided to go head first into Muay Thai and surprise myself and not get my head knocked off. but I've broken a few body parts, but that's a whole nother evolution.
Yeah. So,
but it was an unbelievable place to train.
Gotcha. So coming from the, you know, the point fighting side, you know, how has that, or has any of that skill set translated into the Muay Thai?
It does, because you go ahead and you learn about timing and rhythm and, you know, knowing how to read your opponent, where in Muay Thai, it's just, you know, as soon as you hear that gong ring, just like in a boxing gym, until the round is over, you know, you're transferring all those things into a continuous, because in point fighting, you know, you get the point, you know, they score, the refs are there, you know, giving their red flag or white flag up or down, who got the point, where in Muay Thai, it's just continuous. And so even if you get hit or you deliver a strike, then you keep going. So in that aspect, the point fighting helps as far as like trying to read your opponent and your timing and your power and your fluidity. And that's really critical, even in Muay Thai, is fluidity, even when you're light or medium sparring, because in order for you to develop a rhythm, you have to have fluidity. And it doesn't really matter what combat arts that you're taking up with. Once you develop a fluidity and a rhythm, then it actually gets easier to work with the other person that you're training with. And that's what I find that is really necessary, that you that I took from Kenpo into Muay Thai, is that you have to be fluid. If you're stuck and stop and then you stutter, you're just going to make the other guy that you're training with mad.
So besides the Kenpo and Muay Thai, and then the Taekwondo, is there any other arts that you've been involved with? Or
no, but I did have a real interesting exposure to ground fighting and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu when I trained with Mr. Darrow, because before his school closed in the last 2 years, and I can't remember which of the Gracies that he had over at his school, but I remember he had one of them, and I'm sure Senior Grandmaster Wilson could remember this because he's got a far better memory than I ever do, you know. So if you ever reach out to him in Spring Valley, you know, say, hey, you know, Joe forgot, you know, there was, you know, somebody there that Mr. Darrow brought in. He'd be able to tell you. But Darby started incorporating ground fighting in with the Kenpo, and it was a totally different physical conditioning aspect that really kicked my butt, because, you know, it's not like, you know, point fighting, stand up fighting, whatever you want to call it, sparring, where, you know, okay, you've got time to collect your thoughts and then make your move or throw your combination or your kick or whatever. And there it's nonstop. You're trying to guess the next chess move that mm-hmm. that person is going to try to do on you. Like when you're watching UFC, you could tell that, you know, as the guy is either in the guard or he's in the mount, he's trying to think of what his next move is. It's the same thing training with Mr. Darrow. You know, you're trying to, and these guys that Mr. Darrow, you know, were teaching, which was all of us, some of those guys had wrestling experience. I think wrestlers and anybody with a judo background makes it real easy for them to position themselves to accelerate in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which I didn't have no background. So mm-hmm. it was really tough for me, but the conditioning part was just as bad, if not worse, than dealing with like Muay Thai. So because it's continuous and it doesn't stop until the round is over or until you submit, you're on the go. So I was always spent at the end of those sessions.
Yeah. I don't train in BJJ, but I do remember many a nights where one of our friends started training, you know, like with all of us at the time when the UFC came out, and, you know, we were all just kind of mesmerized by, like, what is this? What is this jiu-jitsu, you know, Brazilian jiu-jitsu stuff? What is this Gracie stuff going on? And one of my friends started training in BJJ with the Machados. Mm-hmm. And he would kind of, you know, show us some stuff here and there. And I remember quite a few nights where we would, after class, we would, you know, break out, trying to get our Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu on, and we would just be at it for hours and hours, and just completely worn out, completely just drenched in sweat. And it's like, man, how do these guys do this? You know, I remember some of those early UFCs, and it was like, well, you know, we don't have a time limit, and they, you know, have like, you know, Hoist and Ken Shamrock and stuff going at it for, you know, an hour or so, and it was just crazy stamina and just crazy energy. But, you know, it's like you said, it's, you know, that chess game of just trying to figure out, you know, how to not only apply your move but not get put in the position to where they can do a move on you. So.
Correct.
So that's huge. So, so kind of with that, you know, exposure, are you going to be, you know, getting into the BJJ, or?
You know, at this point in time, I'm just happy I can continue to train in Muay Thai and what body parts don't break, because I found out for a couple of years ago that, you know, I talked to my doctor and he was like testing me for blood pressure. He goes, hey, your blood pressure is a little bit high. You know, I want you to, you know, do some stuff here. And I came back and a couple of months later, you know, he goes, it's still high. So he tried to get me on on lisinopril, and I wouldn't do it because the medicine made me drowsy. Well, that's really what sparked my change of diet, because I'm a private pilot. I've been flying since, the middle 2000s. And if I was to lose my license because of my blood pressure, it would be a difficult process to retain and get my license back. I would rather sell my kids if I could than lose my pilot's license, even though they're all grown up and nobody wants them. But anyway, that's a whole nother story. So that's why the Muay Thai was a motivational factor to keep my health in check. So my blood pressure is good and my diet and all that kind of stuff. So that's why I just really take to that like a fish out of water. I just got to make sure that I try not to get too injured now. And so it's like what I tell people when they go into any of the combat arts. It's not if you get hurt, it's going to be when. And all you can do is just try to take the best care of yourself. And if you do get injured, try to do what you can to recover as quickly as possible and get back into it. And don't stop. Because once you stop, it's hard to get back into it. So that's my whole philosophy in training, is that I just keep training. And I guess I'll keep training until I can't anymore and I'm no longer on this earth. But that's a whole nother issue.
I like to say, I'm going to train until 10 minutes after I'm dead, and then I can stop. But keeping it going is crucial. And in kind of today's world of technology and all this, it's good to have something where you're moving, getting that blood pumping and the heart beating and the body movement. I work in the IT world, so I'm behind a screen all day long, and then I come home and I'm still behind the screen. Having Kenpo and having the martial arts to keep me going is really, really crucial. And I think more people need to have that in their lives to keep things going. Let me do something here. This is going to be kind of bad pod, but maybe I might be able to edit this in. So my next guest, Lee Wedlake, is actually just popped in.
Oh, wow. So,
I'm going to bring him in and kind of get him up to speed here. And we'll kind of jump back into things here. One sec. Hello.
All right, Reggie Darton.
Hello, Mr. Wedlake. Thank you so much for being on. So as you can probably see, I am on with Mr. Mariello here. So I'm going to, let's see, what am I going to do? If you don't mind holding on for a little bit while we finish up, and then we'll jump in.
Sure.
Mr. Wedlake.
Good to see you.
Excellent. Good to see you, sir. I am honored in your presence. You're very well known in the Kenpo world there. I am just but a student, sir.
Hey, well, so am I. That makes two of us.
Me too.
As I'm explaining to Reggie, I've got a lot of folks that I know you've run across that have either trained with or had seminars to deal with. It's an honor to meet you, sir.
Yeah, no, cool. It's good to hear. You don't have a warrant out for me or anything, do you?
No, sir. I'm retired law enforcement also.
Very nice. Very nice. So, yeah. So let's kind of jump back here. Before we hit our kind of lightning round, wanted to ask you just, with all of your training, where do you see the future of Kenpo, or where would you like it to go, or maybe something that changes that that have happened that maybe you're not the biggest fan of? Just kind of what are your thoughts on just kind of where Kempo is heading or where you would like it to head?
Okay, so are you asking me to think about this and then you're going to kick this off in the interview, or are we starting right now?
Well, I would say for you, think about it, because I will ask you that when we do ours.
Okay.
And then for Joe here, what's your kind of thoughts on that?
Well, considering that I've spent the last 10 plus years in the Muay Thai side as opposed to the Kempo side, I still train a lot of the techniques that I learned throughout the years, you know, between Mr. Sepulveda, Mr. Darrow, Mr. Steele, being a dummy for Mr. Post also, and I didn't really feel like to be. And I incorporate, you know, in my own personal training, the weapons training, especially any rod or lance techniques, because as prior law enforcement, your biggest fear is running across, you know, either a gun or a knife. Yeah. And so I still incorporate that training in my own personal training, even though I don't always, you know, utilize all the techniques that I've learned throughout the years until I got promoted to my first black. But like I said, I was very fortunate to run across all these people in the field, and even to go to a few seminars and listen to Mr. Hebler. That was always an eye-opening experience. So, you know, those things are still with me. I may not use all the techniques that I've learned. The only great thing about at this point is that years ago, we didn't have YouTube. So if I forget something, mm-hmm. even though I refer back to my book here and all my notes and everything that, you know, started from day one, in the Kempo side, especially in the Parker side, you know, that, you know, Mr. Sepulveda and Mr. Hancock told me, hey, you got to have a notebook. And I was like, notebook? What's that? And so I had to put all the techniques in there, you know, the sparring techniques, the forms. And then when I remember, I still even have my black belt thesis when I tested for first black. It's still in that book there. It's incredible. But with all that volume, the most important part is that, like what Pete covered in his thing, is in his own podcast with you, is that you use what you need to use in order to fit it for your body style, your system that Mr. Parker talked about. And you adapt it for you to win if you're forced into that situation. And that's really what I take from Kempo, because I still utilize it, even though I've been in Muay Thai for like the last 10 plus years. Even though I don't know why. I keep getting hit across the side of the head way too many times. But anyway.
Very nice. Very nice. Okay. So, yeah, let's hit our little lightning round here as we close in on wrapping up for our time today. So the first thing being, and this might be a little bit challenging since you've been kind of, I guess, kind of distanced from Kempo a little bit, but do you have a favorite technique?
Well, I'm just going to go with delayed sword, because I always figure that anybody that challenges a little guy like me at 130 pounds, they're going to try to grab me. So I'm going to try to, you know, utilize, you know, some sort of defense against that grab. And then from there on, then you have to go ahead and figure out what we're going to do. I'm always looking for basically three things: a grab, a push, and a weapon. At least in my world, when I'm out in the street there, because living in Southern California, you know, growing up here, it's different than it is today. And I always think that, you know, something bad can happen, and if it can, it will. So you, as far as I'm concerned, as soon as I step out the door, I better be ready. And that's the mentality I take when I train in the morning, because I still train every day, even if it's just for, you know, 30 minutes. And like I said, I utilize all the basic 10 techniques, you know, that they teach all of all the yellow belts, you know, the late sword, alternating maze, sword of destruction, you know, deflecting hammer. I still use that, and I still go over that, because it could be something as basic, and deflecting hammer is actually one of my favorite techniques. It's actually my favorite technique as opposed to the late sword, because I figure everything is going to start from at that point, even though I believe the original technique is against a kick. But usually somebody, because I'm so short, at 5'4", they're going to come to my head, and I'm just going to go there. I'm going to go here. I'm going to go up there. And so, and then if there's a weapon, then I'll try to utilize one of the rod or lance techniques in order to defend myself. Even though they always say, you know, you should go ahead and anticipate giving yourself up. I'm like, no, I'm not going to. I'm not going to be a victim. That's just the way it is. That's just my mentality.
Yeah.
Very nice. Very nice. I like it. Okay. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
You know, I haven't done six in a long time, but I love that. And I especially love staff set. I had a two-sectional staff that was built out of a pull cue that I would screw together, and I would start off and practice staff set in the studio with Mr. Darrow when he had his school. And I don't know if I ever did that in Mr. Wilson's school over in Spring Valley, but I would definitely practice staff set. That was one of my favorites. Still is.
Very nice. Very nice. I like it. I like it. Okay. If there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be?
I have two. I have two people. One is Mr. Liam Harrison, who's a retired Muay Thai fighter right now out of, it's not K1, it's one of the other federations, but I like watching his techniques and his combinations. The other one is I'd like to pick apart Mr. Parker's brain and how he developed. Because when you look at it, when you look at Kempo and how he developed it when he was a college student, I think at BYU, and then he managed to put the system together. And I know that there's other people and folks that have done their own interpretation, but it's interesting to see how he took a concept and made it into a worldwide, you know, cutting edge martial arts combat system. And to me, that's kind of innovative. How did he come up with that and develop that? I know a lot of it developed from his childhood growing up in Hawaii, but to me, that's just fascinating that you could come up with that. And there's so many disciples and people that follow his teachings today, you know. Even though I consider myself both a Muay Thai and to some extent a Kempo artist.
Gotcha. I like it. I like it. All right. So the last question, and this is the hardest of all.
Okay.
So in honor of Mr. Parker's love of jokes and humor, do you have a joke to share with us?
You know, this almost sounds like my days in the military, because when you're the new guy, either Navy and to some extent probably Air Force squadrons, they ask you to tell a joke. Now, I do have a joke, but I can't tell it because it isn't fit for, you know, this audience. And you know, this is before the politically correct military that it is now, because when I came into the active duty in 1980, there was still stuff that was going on that would make, you know, even the most, I guess, politically correct people a little bit shy. With that being said, Mr. Reggie, I will pass on that.
That's a great, great answer. I have plenty of jokes,
but they're all not fit for, they're not fit for anything but less than, I don't even think I could get it down to the PG level. So.
Yeah, no, I'm in basically the same boat. I have the same few jokes that, I've been telling since an age that I shouldn't not have been telling these jokes, but, yeah, I still have the same few ones, and it's like, yeah, they're not appropriate for this forum. So, I like it, but so yeah, I thank you so much for being on. This is, now is your time for shameless self promotion. So, if there's anything you wanted to bring up or mention,
like I told you, if you need to reach out to me, Reggie, I'm on LinkedIn. I have a LinkedIn page, which is for my actual profession outside of law enforcement. And then on my personal page on Facebook, I am Joe Sharkey. There's a lot of famous pictures in there that I have with Kempo greats that I've told you about. Unfortunately, I don't have a picture of Mr. Sepulveda. I was looking for a Grandmaster Sepulveda's picture, even though I was his student for like about a year or two. But I've got I think a picture or two of Mr. Helbler with Mr. Post, some other folks there like Dan Maxwell and a couple of other people. I'm sure Mr. Wedlake knows a few of those folks. So, you know, those are actually part of my personal Facebook page, and those will always be treasured. Those will always be treasured.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, yeah, no, I thank you again so much for your time and for, you know, sharing your story. Definitely have to have you back on for more goodness. But I just really appreciate you and thank you for being on, and we will.
Thank you, Mr. Wedlake. It was great meeting you, sir.
You too, Joe. Take care of yourself.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.